Center 4 Lima Mike. If you read me, I'm descending for Dodge City for a fuel pump.
November 4 Lima Mike, it's 12 to 1 o'clock and 20 miles. But they're showing the visibility is a quarter mile and fog, indefinite ceiling 200 feet. You will not be able to get in there VFR.
Oh my goodness. What's near me that I can get down there, please?
November 4 Lima Mike, there's some, I think, some good conditions up towards Scott City, but that's 80 miles ahead. How much fuel do you have?
Well, I was heading for there originally, but I am not, it's a new airplane to me, and I'd rather not go that far if I just don't have to.
Hello and welcome to the NACA podcast. I'm Doug Church, Deputy Director of Public Affairs at the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. On a Thursday afternoon in September 2020 in the Prairie area of Kansas City Center, it was just 6 months into the COVID pandemic. The facility was staffed with small teams of controllers working their shifts together for safety reasons, but still handling very busy traffic volumes at times. ZKC member Inga Owens was working a Yak-18T that was headed north toward Nebraska from Texas. The pilot was encountering two very big problems. First, he was flying this aircraft for the first time, delivering it to its owner. It was burning fuel at a rate exceeding what he was told it would, leaving him with a shortage that led him to declare an emergency. Second, he encountered IFR weather conditions in western Kansas airspace with 200-foot minimum ceilings. Owens had fellow ZKC member Taylor Rosenbaum as her D-side controller, while member Brett Rolofson was working as the controller in charge. The three members worked to help the pilot to a safe landing. For their efforts, they will receive the Archie League Medal of Safety Award for the Central Region on June 17th in New Orleans. I had the chance to talk to the three controllers recently. Here is my conversation.
I want to start by doing a little bit of background. How long have the three of you been working together? And if you want to go around your background as far as your ATC career and how you got into the profession, I want to start with Inga.
Sure. Yeah, I've been at Kansas City for just coming up on 6 years, 5.5 years now. So I would have worked with Brett that entire time. And then Taylor, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I got there. It's kind of a blur, but and then general background. I turned 15 in the FAA yesterday, so here comes 8 hours pay period. Yeah. I started in a level 6 tower in California, Sacramento tower, and then for 3 years, and then I went to NorCal TRACON for 7 years, and then the center since then.
Okay. Fantastic. Taylor.
Yeah, I've been at Kansas City for, I think, coming up on 4 years this November, 3.5 years right now. So I've worked with Brett and Inga the entire time. Brett was one of my trainers here. And let's see, before that, I was in Springfield, Missouri, tower and approach for about 2.5 years prior to coming here. So okay. About 6-7 years so far in the agency.
And Brett?
I've been in the agency, it'll be 14 years in June, so a little bit 13 years and 11 months. I've been at Kansas City Center the whole time and in the same area the whole time. So I've worked with both them as long as they've been in the area.
Sorry.
So before we start talking about the event itself that this happened almost 2 years ago now, September 3rd, 2020, obviously 6 months into the COVID-19 pandemic at that point, how did that situation in terms of what the things were like inside the facility sort of affect how you handled the situation? Can you kind of set the scene for what the staffing was like, what the traffic was like, how much different then compared to now, May of 2022, almost 2 years later?
Yeah, this is Brett. So with the COVID crews, we had a pretty tight-knit crew. It was a small crew, but I felt like we all did a good job of when somebody needed help, nobody had problems coming back and working together. In this particular scenario, when Inga had the emergency, I was CIC. Taylor was a radar trainee, but he was qualified on the D side. So at the time that the emergency happened, we ended up having to shuffle around some sectors. We brought a guy down from sector 21 and he took over all the low freaks, so we could isolate the emergency on one frequency. The guys that were working the high altitude kind of had to work a little bit busier traffic than usual and didn't have any qualms or issues doing that. Taylor had no problems jumping in on the D side. And then as Inga was there to support the pilot in his needs. You know, we were all there and as a team to help support her and her needs and get her resources as she needs them. So yeah, I felt like having the smaller crew actually may have worked, like it worked out really well considering how well we were working together through not only the time of the emergency, but through the whole COVID pandemic.
Okay. Inga or Taylor, anything to add on that question?
This is Inga. I would only add that kind of to Brett's point that, yeah, that time was kind of a bonding period. We were on the 5-5 schedule at that point. And we were, some of the areas were pretty lucky in that they didn't have much going on, but Prairie was, tends to be a little bit of an exception. And we were getting our butts kicked about every day. I remember going home exhausted and taking a nap that, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 5 in the evening every day because of the fatigue, because we were working pretty hard. We were long sits. And so there was, you know, there's some bonding when you're in the trenches with your buddies. It's trying. So, and then, yeah, that the day of the incident, I mean, that only further kind of bonds you having to go through something like that and seeing how the people around you react and respond. But that's all I would add.
Okay. So let's talk about the aircraft and the pilot involved before we set the scene for the event itself. So a Yak 18T.
Yeah, that's not, I don't feel like that's an aircraft we see. I mean, I don't know if I've seen one before and I haven't seen one since that I recall.
That was my question. I'm going to be my question to you is how often does this particular aircraft cross your means? But so from what I could tell from Nathan's nomination of the event for the award, the pilot was delivering the aircraft to its owner. So perhaps that's the reason why it had never crossed your airspace before. Just the speculation there. The pilot himself, I'm told, has 52,000 flying hours. So somebody,
wow.
That's pretty experienced, right?
Yes, thank goodness.
Did you know at the time how did he seem as far as his ability to handle that situation?
I mean, very calm. This is Inga. He seemed calm. I do recall, I don't know if Taylor will remember this. I remember it was a low IFR day, a little bit labor intensive because everybody needs an approach, you know, somewhere. And there was moderate precipitation. We were kind of, you know, we were busy helping people with that. And I remember he was a VFR aircraft at that point. And I remember kind of neglecting him in that I wasn't telling him about the precip, but he was doing his own thing and navigating around it seemingly fine. But I do remember at one point saying to Taylor, I feel like this guy is going to be a problem. And I have no idea what struck me early about that. Maybe it started to slow descent or something at that point. I'm not sure what struck me about that, but.
As far as how he was in terms of, tell that he was experienced or not?
I had no idea of experience until he called afterward and told us. No clue whatsoever. I was just super relieved that when we asked if he were IFR qualified, that the answer was yes, because my fear was that he wasn't, and then I don't know what we would have done. No idea, but very, very grateful that, I mean, you can't ask for more experience than that guy had in a situation like that.
So Taylor, how often do you work as the D side for Inga? Is that you guys work together quite often or all the time?
Yeah, this is Taylor. I guess we used to, you know, at the time we were on the same cruise, so worked together every day, it seemed like, you know, especially that's where I focused most of my days, was on low altitude. So anybody who was sitting there, you know, I was there pretty much, I mean, most of the time, at least. Everybody else was doing longer sit, so I felt like I needed to as well. But don't work with Inga much anymore, unfortunately, but back then, definitely quite a bit.
So the aircraft en route from Texas north up to Scott City when he was about 20 nautical miles south of Dodge City. That's when he told you, Inga, that he needed to land for fuel and was planning that as his stop. Can you take us from that point when you got the call at that particular moment and kind of start to take us through the sequence of events? And I'll let, you know, Taylor and Brett sort of chime in with the details as you take us through what happened.
Sure. I mean, this is Inga. I'll try to remember again. It's been such a long time. I don't think he was going to Scott City either, but I thought he was going somewhere else.
I thought he was going further northwest, like Nebraska or something. But
yeah, I did too.
I agree.
But kind of irrelevant. He wasn't going to make it to Scott City either. So, yeah, like I said earlier, I remember at some point thinking something, this guy was going to be a problem. I don't recall why. And then a few minutes passed, you know, if my memory serves me at all correctly. And he, I remember noticing him descending like he was going to land Dodge City and addressing it. And that weather was bad. I mean, it was below minimums. I wish I could remember exactly if it was 100 or 200 feet overcast, but it was
200 feet is what I'm reading.
200. So I think that might be maybe right at minimums. I'm not sure, but it was very low, which was very concerning. But you know, he somehow communicated that he was running out of gas or out of gas and needed to land. And I know that we were scrambling looking for VFR airports and there was nothing anywhere nearby. I mean, Scott City might have been one of the VFR spots, but it was, I mean, it was like 80 miles maybe or something. It was way too far. There was not a chance to get him in VFR conditions. You know, we posed the question, are you IFR capable? And again, thank goodness he was, because then it's sort of routine, right? Yes, he's running out of gas. I don't know how dire. I don't know that we ever knew how dire the gas situation was, if it was, you know, fumes at that point or what. But then it just became, you know, giving this guy as good of an approach as we possibly could, made sure he had the information about the weather, doing any of those sorts of things to accommodate him. I remember he specifically asked for a short approach, which we're limited to do that. It can't be in IFR conditions. Mm-hmm. And I remember there being a conversation and some concern about what supersedes in the emergency. Do you give the short approach? Do you risk it being, I don't know what you're taking away from the pilot giving him a short approach in those conditions. Are we making it worse for him? So there was some conversation amongst the crew about that. Yeah, I remember Brett, you couldn't have a better CIC that day. It was such a good thing that Brett, even over a supervisor, was in at the helm that day, because he just made all the right moves. I mean, this Sector 21 controller, I remember him running over and just absorbing airspace and frequencies with no briefing whatsoever. And let's see, I'm not sure what else is significant. I mean, the guy seemed like he was having a little bit of trouble holding altitude, and I hated to encourage him to climb because I don't want to burn any more fuel than he's got. But
sure,
we got him down, and there was a supervisor on the phone with the airport, and we got the landing confirmation in real time, and that was an enormous relief. I don't know that I felt a wash of relief like that in my life, and I hope I don't ever need to again, because it was something. We were lucky to get that confirmation as quickly as we did, because I thought there was going to be a lot of time that passed. We were kind of like, what happened? So
safe to say this was the most dramatic urgent situation you had been involved with before or since in your career?
Yes, I would say so.
Okay. So you would look for the, while he was, you know, had not a lot of fuel left, perhaps about 30 minutes or so, you were looking for the VFR reports, couldn't find any. You also talked to other pilots in the area to see what their flight conditions were, trying mm-hmm. to find, you know, those VFR conditions. Mm-hmm.
And I remember, this is Taylor, I remember too, we looked up the weather for Dodge City, and it was right at minimums or just below minimums even. And Garden City's, what, 20, 25 miles west of there, it was slightly better. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was 100 feet better. As far as the cloud layer. And we asked him, like, hey, can you make Garden City even? And he said, no, I don't think I can make Garden City even. 25 minutes west, landing to the north, or 25 miles west, excuse me, landing to the north, couldn't even quite make it that far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you talked to him after the event was over, did he mention at all that it might have been his first time flying this particular aircraft, or would we not know that answer?
This is Inga. We didn't speak with him. I didn't. He called. He must have called and spoken with one of the, was it the OM or the soup? He called and talked to one of the guys up at the front desk. Okay. That's where we got all the details about his experience and how low he actually was on fuel. So
in the nomination, it was written that he was rated, the plane was rated for 58 liters per hour. The pilot calculated it was burning fuel at that during this event at 74 liters per hour. Wow. Do you have any idea why, what the reason would be that it was burning that much more fuel than what the plane was rated to do? Is there any explanation for why that occurred? Was it altitude or?
My understanding was that this is Inga, that the POH was just inaccurate. The information that he had, the literature was inaccurate. So it was burning what it's supposed to be burning. It just, the information that he had was, it was a different number that he had. So he calculated correctly based on the numbers he was provided.
Okay.
That was my understanding.
Yeah, this is Brett. That's exactly what I had heard too, was he was given the wrong numbers. And I think originally, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Inga, but I'm pretty sure that the original state of the situation was that he was VFR and he was on top of these clouds. So we weren't sure if he was instrument rated or not. And then, and originally he had thought that he had an issue with his gas gauge because he didn't think that it was possible that he could be that low on fuel. So originally it was, I need to get on the ground. I think there might be an issue with the gas gauge. And I can remember at that point running up to the weather guy and asking him, you know, is there a break in the clouds anywhere out near Dodge City or Coldwater, Kansas? Because this guy needs to get down through the clouds. He's VFR at this point. We didn't know he was IFR capable. And I remember him just, you know, well, let me pull up. And I was like, all right, you're going to have to just do that and let come down and let me know. Because he kind of started to take his time there. So we started, I came back. I think that you guys started soliciting to aircraft or whatnot and just trying to find a break in the clouds. And then when the pilot told us he was IFR capable, it became a different ballgame. But
I had forgotten that detail about the where he thought it was his gauges. I had forgotten that. But yes, that sounds right.
Have you, this is a hypothetical and probably an unfair question, but have you thought at all about what you would have done had he not been IFR capable? I mean, in that kind of a situation where you know he's low on gas, just do the best you could vector wise or?
Yeah, this is Inga. Yeah, I've thought about that extensively because that's a totally different scenario and a much scarier one. And I guess I wish this were something that we would have sat down and talked about as a group afterward, because I guess you vector them as best you can. We're limited radar and radios there. So you're going to get to a point where how precise can you be lining someone up to an airport, you know, maybe directly with the runway, even in a case like that, where the layers are so low. So yes, I've thought about it a great deal. I don't know what the answer is. I wish someone would tell me.
I thought about it. We had a guy on our COVID crew, Ben Phelan, who flies airplanes. And the solution, I think, would have been maybe to get him in on the control aspect to talk to him as a pilot.
Okay. And
work him down through the clouds as from a pilot's perspective. But once he was IFR capable, then that wasn't really needed at the time, I guess. But that was my thoughts originally whenever we were trying to get him down through the clouds to send Ben over there to talk to him about.
Yeah, this is Taylor. And I think for me, the thing I thought about most, no matter how we approached it, I thought the workload would go up immensely, because not only are you having to provide vectors on our low altitude airspace at the time was big. You know, obviously we got rid of most of the aircraft, but in terms of having to talk to this person that's never flown in the clouds before, you know, talking to them about focusing on your instruments and that sort of stuff, rather than looking around in the clouds, because you can get disoriented so quickly up there without any sort of training. I mean, no matter how it went down, I think the workload would have gone up drastically.
Yeah.
You know, as you were talking there, I had spotted this here in the event description from that was the part of the nomination again, and I can confirm that it was written that he was ferrying this aircraft and it was his first flight in it.
Yeah.
So that does explain a lot there as far as, you know, the uncertainty about the fuel and the theory that he had, rightly so at the time, that perhaps there was a gauge problem. So all of those things now add up even further. Taylor, can you talk more about what you witnessed during this whole thing, what your role was, and the different tasks that you had to perform during this event?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Taylor. I feel like for me, honestly, I feel like I didn't do much. I felt like I did as much as I could, but I didn't do much. I helped pull up the weather. I helped pull up the approach. But for me, it was a lot of just focusing on how good of a job Inga was doing, but also how much everybody else in the area was doing. You know, you have Nate Birch, who was essentially a pseudo tracker behind Inga, kind of helping guide a little bit. You had Scott Hedrick, who closed the super high sectors and came and took all our airplanes from low. You had Ben Phelan and Scott Lonizak, who took all those extra airplanes from the super high airspace. For me, it was just noticing how much everybody was doing and how much everybody was working. You know, Brett's running up to the weather unit and trying to, you know, I think at one point even he may have called Denver. I could be wrong on that. I feel like, Brett, you called Denver even to ask if they knew if there was any VFR airports at, you know. But it was just, for me, it was just seeing how much of a team effort it was. But then once it came down to it, it's focusing on how good of a job Inga was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that there was, I don't know that, honestly, I mean, there's a whole lot of other people coming from an approach control, you know, how many other people in the area feel as comfortable as Inga seemed while she was doing it.
Yeah.
When you, that's so beautifully stated. And I appreciate that. You know, the team aspect is something that ties together this and many, many other Archie League events, obviously, that we've witnessed over the years. Where does that come from, is in terms of the three of you and all of your colleagues at the center in an event like this, coming together so quickly, putting your heads together, making decisions quickly? Does it come from the experience, from the training? How can you explain how well you all can work in such a specific, urgent, time-sensitive situation like that and be able to make decisions that are precise and accurate?
This is Taylor again. I'll go. I feel like for me, I mean, they were all on the COVID crew before. I was at home for a while before they ended up needing me to come back and start working just because it got busier. And I feel like, you know, especially in this situation, but I guess overall as well, when you work with good people, we had a really good crew. When you work with really good people consistently, you kind of learn each other's mannerisms and, you know, what everybody can do, what everybody's best at. And I think the, you know, timing of it is a big deal too. Everything just kind of lined up perfectly for us that day. And it, you know, when you work with people all day long, 6 days a week for years and years and years, you kind of, everybody kind of gets to know each other obviously pretty well and becomes a little closer and kind of learns to work together a little bit without really saying a whole lot.
Okay. Brett, any comments about that question?
No, I mean, I agree. I know that our area is very difficult. One of the most difficult probably in the center. And it's, we have 9 different frequencies in our low altitude. I think that we all have an understanding of the workload that it takes, especially around lunchtime, 2 o'clock-ish. In that time frame, especially during COVID, it was very, very, very busy. So we all understand what it's like to work just regular traffic and then understand that when there's a special need or a high intensity situation, that everybody knows that it just takes a village to start helping the controller get the resources that they need so that they could focus and really zone in and do their job. And, you know, I can't speak highly enough of how well Inga handled the whole situation, given the way that it transpired and just the intensity of it. And to kind of go back to the pilot and flying the airplane for the first time, I mean, you can tell this guy was getting below the MIA. She was incredibly patient, just advised him of it. Try not to be too intrusive with the guy. She was very diligent and delicate with the guy. The vectors that she gave him to join the ILS were absolutely perfectly spot on. He was coming in from below the glide slope, which is lower than usual for hitting the ILS. So the whole situation was like, we don't know if this guy's plane is sputtering. We don't know if he can't maintain altitude. We don't know. And I guess it shows now that his lack of time in that specific airplane, even though he's an incredibly experienced pilot, that it really does make a difference. And so her calmness of her voice and the way that she handled the whole situation and was able to do that because of the village around her, you know, absorbing some more workload and letting her focus and do what she does best. Really, I think in this situation, gave this guy an opportunity to get on the ground as expeditious as he possibly could. Mm. And yeah, I mean, it was really just a cool situation whenever he got on the ground, for sure.
Absolutely. Great. Thank you so much for that. Let me close with a question for each of you to answer. I'll start with Brett, because you're one of the very rare members who now is winning this award for a second time. So it's truly an honor to see that occur, and it's so well deserved. What are your thoughts about being selected for the award this time, and you know, what that means to you?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a complete honor to be selected. Obviously, last time I was training, and became the radar controller really quick, and it was a really fast situation, completely different than this situation. They're all different in their own means. I don't think that anybody goes into work looking to win an Archie League award. I would rather not win one again. I honestly really, really appreciate the nomination. I feel like I had a more instrumental role probably the first time, just because talking with pilots and being an air traffic controller, that's our natural knack, is that we have more control if we're the actual controller. But, I guess that, it's just one of those things that just happens. And when you win one, it's not like you're like, knew that when the day that it was happening, you didn't expect it to happen. It just seemed like a regular old day at work. And then a year and a half later, or whatever it's been, to find out that I won, I honestly, for the second time, I told Aaron, I was like, well, I don't think it was me. I don't remember what you're talking about. And then he started bringing up the situation. I remembered Inga's situation and this whole, how it all transpired. And then when you replay it in your head, you realize how special those moments are. And sometimes whenever you're in the moment, you don't really have time to reflect on what you just accomplished by saving somebody's life. So it really is an honor at the same time to be nominated for any kind of Archie League, but it's not really something that you look for or expect recognition for, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, it does. Thank you. Inga?
Yeah, Brett said all that so well. Brett's point, it's an honor. It's a humbling honor. You struggle with thinking, I didn't do anything, or I struggle with, I didn't, all the things that I should have done better or didn't do, or I wish that we would have thought to do that it could have maybe helped a little bit more. I feel like we got very lucky in a lot of ways, but I can't tell you how much it means to me, the support that I had around me that day, those guys, that the rallying that goes on, it makes you so proud to be a controller, to be part of this job. That's the stuff that, the public doesn't see that would be kind of neat if they could see. But again, you could not have had a better CIC in their shoes. Brett is such a problem solver. There is nothing you can put in front of Brett that he won't get creative about and figure out some alternatives. He will find a way to make things work. So you could not have asked for a better person there. And Taylor, I know you don't feel like you did anything. You keep saying it, but
I did.
Just your calm presence being there, honestly, having a human being next to you, talking through these things, pulling up the wet, like just your presence was, it meant I needed you there. I needed you there. So thank you both very much for being there.
And Taylor?
Yeah, kind of just reiterate what they said. I mean, I really do feel like it's an honor. It's not something that I ever expected. Like Brett said, a year and a half later, I get a voicemail from Aaron Merrick, mm-hmm. and he's telling us we won, whatever. And then, an hour and a half later, he texts me and he says, hey, by the way, it's just coming to my understanding that you may not even know you guys were nominated for it, let alone won it. So, it was kind of a shock. And yeah, real honor, for me. Like Inga said, the team aspect of it was a big deal for me. Part of me wishes I could, a lot of other people in the area did a lot more than I did for it, So, I wish I could give it to them, but real honor. Absolutely.
Yeah. The whole area deserves it. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, again, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk through this. This is just a great thrill to be able to speak with all of you about this, this event, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the NACA Podcast. I'm Doug Church. Have a great rest of your day.